Please, Representative Young and this person is excused. We are considering today House Bill 1177 relating to loitering on or near the school grounds. It's sponsored by the Committee on Health, Education, and Welfare. Our council has the sign-up sheet. Any of you wish to sign the sign-up sheet who have not already signed it? Is there anyone here from the Committee on Health, Education, and Welfare? What do they mean when they do the legislation? They don't know. Is there anyone here representing the State Board of Education? All right. Would you come forth, please, and since it is introduced at your request, we'd like to know why it has been introduced and so forth. Would you give your name for the record who you're representing?
Sir, my name is Ronald Fahill from the State Department of Education.
You're not a member of the board, are you? Are you a member of the board?
No, I'm not. I'm legislative analyst with Dr. Fahill.
There's no one here from the board itself.
There's no one here from the board.
Go.
Mr. Chairman, recently in at the Union High School, there was an incident with an individual. Several individuals came on the campus, and the principal apparently applied the arrestment for disorderly conduct or loitering, and apparently the law that he used was ruled unconstitutional by the Attorney General.
What did he use, you know?
I believe it was ORS section 166.060.
Same one that's being amended here, but.
Right.
Okay.
The department decided that the DOD needed to strengthen that law and the DOD and the work that was done on the Oregon Criminal Code on section 222, the document I'm reading from this
gentleman.
That's on page 215. The department decided, Mr. Chairman, that they would pick up the language which was recommended in the revised criminal code, place it in the ORS 166060, so that in case the proposed criminal code did not pass in this legislature, that provision would be enacted into law by the enactment of this bill, if this bill should pass. It's an attempt to clarify a problem by using, again, the same language which is being recommended by the criminal code to insert into this bill. And that's the main reason for this bill being submitted. So.
Question from the committee.
The session, no, that's the latest session. That's
right.
You say it was a whatever the session was. So it was just invited again.
That's what I understand. Mr. Chairman, for discussing that, I would suggest you perhaps want to discuss that with Mr. Linklater. I'm in the Attorney General's office to handle the education concerning.
Well, the only thing then is that in the language, in the latest discussion.
Yes.
What's the thing?
Change the same which is in this bill, which is to be in here. God says that any person who wanted to be a few days or now does not have any reason to raise it involved in touching the other responsibility for a fee and not having any permission from anyone authorized to grant the same.
And the other part of the language was that it's so long as he wasn't a fee bill.
That's right.
It's for 2 and 4 years.
Let the record show that Mr. Young, who wasn't clear, he joined us.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, red and white shirt.
Cover of blood.
Tom, we're discussing House Bill 1177, and the witness who is representing the Board of Education has just identified the new portion of 1177 as similar to that in section 222 of the new proposed code. Now, do you have any more questions right now, Mr. Hollinger?
So you may know when we do it.
I don't know. I couldn't answer that question. The only thing I can tell you is the reason why we prepared the bill. Whether or not that language be upheld, I think you want to discuss with possibly Mr. Linklater. He has reviewed it. His review of our bill and the material which is in the criminal code of the language is the same. Whether or not it answers the problem, you have to discuss that with him.
You don't have a copy of it.
I think he said that, I think that the testifier said that they took a plus case, a different plus case, and Lane County that was really thrown out. I don't think you see it in the page. I don't see them on the legacy package and the court rules now that they're not to do that.
I don't know if
it's the end.
I don't think
it's
the
end. Now, is that the only instance that you know of, the one involving, and you don't know what happened to the case or anything like that?
Right.
That's the only instance that you're aware of. Have there been, has there been widespread complaints of inability to get people off school grounds who are supposed to be there or anything like that?
I understand, Mr. Chairman, that I don't believe there's concern that there has been a great number of cases in which people have been facing the problem of what to do with people on the campus. I think it's a question of if this should happen again, what could the principal do to maintain water on the campus? I think this is what we're searching for.
Maybe somebody else has to have a question. Other questions?
You mentioned Friday. Just what we comment on it, huh? Is that what you're trying to do?
None of the disorder of campus, or disorder of the conduct caused by the students, but someone coming to under the campus is not a student, causing some type of disruption, how do you handle that situation is what we're trying to get at. And I think this is probably what's really going to be that discussion when we get into the procedure on going through the criminal court itself, the language that you adopt doesn't take care of that situation.
Well, I think that's the question you can tell on the report.
It's a third party. Like I say, if I'm not an attorney, I don't get the link later with the individual going to that type of thing.
This is the statute that the name of the county is worthy and not just for the county, so we can learn from that.
Well, there's nothing further than this witness. I thank you for coming tonight. Tom, do you have anything to say about this?
No, I really don't. I think this is something that's been on my mind for years. What I suspect is that you would have several schools coming here.
You know what? It would help us if we had that.
I think my upstairs is John Forrest, which is a wrestling newspaper.
Yeah. Or Bill Linklater, he would have some ideas about it. Do you know what
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, the next person we have on my list is Carl Dukinowicz, American Civil Liberties Union. Come forward.
For the record, my name is Charles Rubinowicz. I'm an attorney. I'm state of Oregon, and I'm representing the American Civil Liberties Union, which has a very emphatic position against this particular statute. We have a couple of reasons for being against it. The primary one is we believe it's unconstitutional, and it deprives the person of his basic constitutional rights, which are guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution and his rights under the Oregon Constitution. First of all, what the amended ordinance proposes to do is state that a person, even if they have a lawful purpose, may not loiter around a school ground. This means that you can be waiting for a bus, you can be handing out leaflets, all of which is lawful. You can be waiting for a friend, you could be walking your little child around the school building. If a policeman feels that you're loitering, in his discretion, you can be arrested, prosecuted under this ordinance. Secondly, the term loitering is a vague term. It's indefinite, and we believe that the courts in Oregon and the federal courts would strike this down as void for vagueness and unconstitutional under the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. This has already been held unconstitutional. The term of loitering, which held void for vagueness, in an Albany case involving loitering in a school ground, it's been held unconstitutional in a number of states in the country, and we think that it would also be unconstitutional in the state of Oregon. Another problem with the statute is that it states that any person having written permission from anyone authorized to grant written permission may do what is known as loiter around the school building. And it's not clear at all who would have authorization to grant the thing. Is it a custodian around the building? Does it have to be the principal of the school? Can it be a teacher? Can it be a member of the city recreation department? Just who does that control? I'd like to get back to this loitering problem again. It's just an unduly vague term. A person can be jogging around the school building, and we think that under this ordinance he could be arrested under this provision. A father could take a baseball and hit some baseball to his son, or throw some baseball to a three-year-old son, and be convicted under this ordinance of loitering around the school building. The very problem with the vagueness, a statute which is vague, is that it sets large discretion in the enforcement authorities, for example, the police. Whoever the police don't approve of, they can arrest. If a person has a beard, if they don't like this particular person for one reason or another, they can arrest them under this statute. It seems to me that what the problem is, in our office in Portland, we discussed this previously. John C. Beatty, who is now a judge in the Multnomah County Circuit Court, I discussed this with previously, and he was concerned about people, he was formerly a member of the Portland Board of Education. He was concerned about people standing around school buildings selling narcotics or trying to cause riots in the school building, and he was concerned that something could be done about this, but he didn't think that this would be the answer, arresting people simply for loitering. The evil that this statute is trying to get at is some kind of disorderly conduct, it appears, and it's just going about it in the wrong way, and it's going to subject a lot of innocent people serious consequence that this ordinance was, if this act were passed as is.
All right. You have been arrested. Representative Collins, have you any questions to ask?
Yes. If anyone representing the American Civil Liberties Union appears in the event that would help to.
I'm not aware of one way or the other on that.
Okay.
wondering how he's gotten by without the proposition to put the payment there. The commentary that accompanies the indicates that they would still travel and talk to people. So maybe they don't suppose to put that money there.
Thank you. One of the present libraries in the statute, I don't know, you have a copy of that, subsection E, the present language, have there been a conviction, to your knowledge, under the present law, for loitering around?
I don't know if there's been any conviction, I'm just aware of the front office case where it was struck down. One of the problems is that we were just notified yesterday of the hearing at this particular time. We haven't really had an adequate opportunity to share ourselves.
Is that just recorded for the court case?
That was I believe that was municipal court in the city of Albany, a municipal statute. But the statute was worded, did then and there willfully loiter about a school. Well, the complaint was worded on the 19th day of September 1968 within the corporate limits of the city of Albany, Oregon. The defendant, in this case, the name was Dan Merritt Norris, then and there, being did then and there on willfully, unlawfully, willfully loiter at a public school, which is Albany Union High School, a public premises adjacent thereto, not being enrolled as a student, not being employed by the public school. Contrary to the ordinance in said case, is made and provided against the peace and dignity of the city of Albany, which is somewhat similar to Section 8, as it was, as it presently stands.
Assuming that the problem is that the school is a sundry. Two people off the school grounds, and once they find out that it's a more appropriate reality than I do. And I kind of tend to agree with you that this lawyer and this is part of the school is coming about. You have an alternative for it, though. If you have the school piece of sanitary, you take care of that stuff.
As I stated, that Mr. Beatty and Judge Beatty and I have discussed this about a year ago. And at that time, we had no other alternative. That the only way you can do it is larger police force, better enforcement of the laws that they stand on the books, for example, possession of narcotics, and ordinances directly prohibiting the passing bar. I don't think that this statute does the trick anyway. Yeah.
In the proposed criminal code makes good sort of value judgment. It says, and this is not out of the case, this is a commentary. The person visiting the school on the given approval or attending an authorized school functioning school function are not loitering. I tend to agree with that.
I would, yeah.
Your fear that people would be there on a legitimate business after receiving money?
I think that a person could be merely standing around waiting for someone else. Just happen to be meeting, waiting for someone on a street corner, which happens to be a school located, and I think it could be arrested under this statute. I suppose if you're going to a school play and you don't have custody of or any relationship involving custody or responsibility of a student, I wouldn't think that you'd be arrested under the statute. Or if you're going make the speech to a full assembly as a independent speaker. I don't suppose he could be arrested for loitering, but what is loitering? Loitering is just sort of, nobody really knows what loitering is. It could be anything that someone else feels doesn't have a definite purpose. You could have a baseball team practicing, having an official team practice, and that wouldn't be loitering. And you could have some fellows just getting together and throwing a baseball around, and that might be loitering. You could have another fellow. They might. There's that possibility. It depends completely on the discretion of the enforcement officer. If he thinks the spectators may be troublemakers, he could arrest them. I think the statute should be considerably more definite than that.
Since you started with considering the anti-loitering bill, that 5 cents fine. House Bill 1177. Well, that's the only bill we have up for hearing today, so I guess we'll declare the hearing closed. We appreciate the monumental lack of interest in the bill that was shown by the sponsors. And so I suppose we'll declare the hearing closed and we'll find out what we want to do with this stuff. Now, we have a work session 1125, 1126, 1127. Also, 1125 is the juvenile training school. And we have an amendment. Do you want to speak to the two sets of amendments? Jenny, do you want to speak to the amendment?
The first set of amendments, which is dated January 29th, will accomplish allowing transfer of a correctional division, a placement by the correctional division, people under the age of 21 who are convicted in adult court and who are not convicted of the crime of murder or rape or actual force involved or treason, and who have not served a previous term of imprisonment in an adult penal institution. These are the same conditions that apply to the 25-year-old and under his little OCI. The second proposed amendment for the second thought, and what they would do would be to allow the corrections division to place anyone under the age of 21 years who has been convicted in adult court into one of the juvenile training schools, regardless of what they may have been convicted of and regardless of whether they may have been in an adult penal institution before.
Okay. Now, we've heard about the amendment. Let me ask you, don't you think that we have to, before we go any farther in this, don't you think we ought to talk to somebody from the correctional
division? I talked to Phil Sam, who is in charge of this portion of the correctional division this morning. I asked him if they didn't feel any concern about this, which no one did appear in testimony. He said that they were in complete accord with the bill. And it was after my discussion with him primarily that I addressed the second proposed amendment, because he felt that it would be very good if the corrections division had true discretion and were not limited by the offense to which they were committed, nor by the prior service in the adult penal institution. And outlined some instances that they had where they would like to transfer people that they have right now, either in the penitentiary or in the correction division to the training school, and if you move in the store addition about serving a previous term of imprisonment in an adult senior institution will not create a problem rather than looking at transfer.
What's your feeling about the age 25 if you would discuss?
My motion to amend that from 8-21 to clear the members that the House wouldn't buy the 8-25.
All right, I'm good.
Now, with this question, the second amendment, it's really question. Well, it's more feeling than it is because if we're talking about youngsters who may be 20 years old and struggling and growing and feeling an adult feeling, it's kind of climbing in it, and I really wouldn't have much to continue to do. These are important to us, the youngsters we're talking about. And so let's say this, going to be this time, my mother. George said he probably could maybe do it soon, I think.
There's some sort of a leveling device too, one of the other points that Bill was making was that you may have a child who may have committed the crime of murder, who in one county would be remanded to adult court and child there and convicted, who in another county would be have been held in juvenile court and gone through the juvenile court process and ended up in the same issue.
Well, this is part of the time when I was moved to the adoption of the second proposed amendment.
Mr. Young moved the adoption of the second proposed amendment dated February 2nd, 1971, to House Bill 1125. The effect of those fees to have line 15 read such persons under the age of 21 years who are committed to the custody of such as may be assigned to a juvenile transfer. Discussion on the proposed amendment?
This is to the
new law
what comprises the correct supervision. They're in terms of all of the things that they're students and they're group supervision. John Galvin.
John Galvin is prepared to correct supervision, and then they're broken up into segments to keep them hidden from the very first and break them into the first to do that. Yeah, Clarence Hill said for the CP. Under all statutes that deal with situations like this, is the affirm that in the judge's provision to such person rather than the judge? Under 137.124, when a person is convicted of a crime in an adult court, they are judged by the judge to the correction provision. The correction provision will assign the defendant or the convicted person to state penitentiary, or if that person is a male under the age of 26 to 50 graduates in government, then to the OCI. The juvenile people are committed by the juvenile court to the correction provision for assignment to the penitentiary. If it is a person, then it will be broken.
The assignment is left totally up to the correction provision, not the judge.
This is a fairly recent origin. This is only been 6 years. The juvenile is going to be affected during the onset of the next portion of the doctrine. The other effort is about 6 years.
Well, Any more discussion on the motion to adjourn? All in favor of the motion to adjourn, say aye. Any opposition or opposition? So it is unanimous. So the bill is amended. Now what do you want to do with it?
I'd like to move it to the full committee to do that recommendation.
Mr. Young moves the House 1125 to refer to the full committee with the recommendation that it should pass. Discussion? Not? Any opposition? So unanimous vote. Okay, 1126. 1126 is the. Juvenile court proceedings bill. And we have one set of amendments on here. Better?
During the discussion on this bill, there were two concerns raised. One of those was whether or not we were cutting off the child's right to allow the court to reveal material in his background to purchase. The child might want to have the information revealed to him. So we retained the privilege that the first portion of the proposed amendment would insert in line 16 the language except at the request of the child, because if the court is too privy to revealing this information to anyone other than parents, to the attorney. And when asking under the rest of the judge, except at the request of the child, but the child says, still not commanding officers in the court to inform his commanding officers. The second portion of it was the new language in the bill would allow attorneys copies of the reports and other material relating to the child's history of diagnosis in many members that Judge Lewis is concerned, that is expressing a concern of the judges that an attorney might have this material in their files and files and have to turn the material over to the parents or to the child. And in this way and possibly other ways, the material might lose its confidentiality. So we inserted the language that the attorneys are entitled to examine and obtain copies of any report, and then a new phrase, any attorney who obtains copies of such reports or materials shall be responsible for preserving their confidentiality and shall return the copies to the court upon the conclusion of his involvement in the case. Which makes it clear that the report material then would not be a part of the attorney's work product because he has to spend more than with the file to stop caught in that situation. And specify his responsibility, which I think is implicit anyway, but it was just spelled out that he's responsible for maintaining the confidentiality.
Okay, you've heard the explanation. Are there any questions of counsel? I'll ask you this. Since you did insert examine and obtain down in paragraph 2, why didn't you put examine and obtain up in line 13?
No. There wasn't any discussion about that. There being a problem in getting copies of the court stories. You make it seem to be unified in terms of it didn't matter if the attorneys entitled copies of all the previous instructions. And we started out and we just wanted to let the attorneys examine the copies of the report. And then we put back in if they could obtain them also. Apparently sometimes they do have a problem examining the material of the previous information.
That's the unofficial file.
Maybe we should put examine and obtain.
Hollingsworth moves that we adopt the proposed amendment 1126, does this also include the further suggestion in line 15? We've heard the motion, is there any discussion? Any opposition? Okay, the amendments were adopted. Unanimous vote. Anything else the committee desires to do?
Well, then also,
Mr. Hollingsworth moves that we recommend that the adoption of this measure to the full committee. Discussion? Opposition? Okay, so ordered. 1127. This is the 16-year-old remand.
This is the one we got hung up on when it's called.
Yeah, I'm not very happy with what I proposed in the amendment. I solved that problem, but I may have solved too much of it. What I did was insert in line 11 of the bill after the new language. Or if he was unavailable to the jurisdiction of the court, or the commission was not contested before he became 16 years of age, then at least 16 years of age at the time of the remand. That leaves the door open for the kid committing the crime at age 15 and a half, and they just don't happen to find out about it until he's 16. Which is part of the problem that the amendment is designed to attack. But it does treat free with kids, you know, coming back into the state perhaps at the age of 17 years, 11 months, and 29 days, and so here I am. And at that point, he's subject to being a court to his
system. And we just add, we have to add an at the end of your proposed amendment so that we have the three.
No, because I'm sticking the proposed amendment in between commission.
Oh, you were thinking, weren't you? Okay.
I started out making it two, and I decided we had to amend all of the statutes to do that, so I made it a long term to continue to do it.
Does the word unavailable include the reservation we had about the possibility of insanity, interim insanity? Unavailable to the jurisdiction of the court, you know. Well, and then you can work the bike run. Well, also, what if he adjudicated insane and unable to withstand trial or remain in indictment or anything else? And then, consequently, he said, same, he has the same problem, and then he becomes bipolar. Not detested before he's 16, or if he's 16 age, if he's wanting to be remandable, if prior to the age of 16 they haven't detested it, or if he has hidden out when he was 16 before. If he could say that the other one to do it would be the president. If he was unavailable to the jurisdiction for her, he would be sent out home to the board to take or the commission wasn't detected before he became 18, which is the point that the human court jurisdiction stopped. So that they were going between 16 and 18 if you, if they bring him into court during that age period for a time that he committed when he was under 16, that he would be handled in the juvenile court.
Isn't that all the time you
do? No, it's by his own actions or what the bill initially was designed to accomplish is to get away from the situation where the kid is 15 and a half time to commit the crime, and they put on the case until he's 16 and then have a remand hearing in the 90s adult court for prosecuting an adult. This is different from the situation where he's 15 and a half to commit the crime and they don't find out about it, or he's in a whole Ohio and doesn't come back until he's 16 and a half to 17. At this point, they then have to charge them with this offense. Or he goes from 7 to 15 and
3-4 to the day. And it doesn't allow you
to do it, you know, you can do it higher. If you draw an advance from that, it's under the current system of the juvenile code, it's from the women who is a lot of kids. But the only assistance or help to the kids would be the business position of where he would be placed. And didn't he take care of that by raising her age to 21? Because the original master would be 16 or 17 at the end of the time.
That would be good. There's an advantage in this position, and then there's another advantage or disadvantage, depending on how you look at it, in being handled in juvenile court with the privacy that attaches to those proceedings and the different kind of proceedings held in juvenile court than the public law and adult court. There is a difference in what it used to happen.
But very shortly, there's actually a pretty decision for the family, like the one that this morning. The gap between criminal, full criminal proceedings and juvenile proceedings is being narrowed. And the next case that comes down is some juvenile from the man who did it out and is very good.
Very bad, as you say to me. Then the other thing is that in adult courts, you have it on your record as a conviction, and in juvenile courts, you don't have it on your record as a conviction.
What is it going on?
We've got statutes saying that juvenile court determination is not a conviction at a cost. So it's not a conviction.
I believe you.
How's the same as that statute? You want me to work on this one?
Well, yeah. I don't think so.
You said something to me. Can you answer me?
No, I don't know. I think it's worthwhile, it's a little bit. You want to do anything about 1177?
I'm not doing most of that,
no. Do you want my bill? I will stand corrected by that, but I don't think our committee can take that kind of action. We can recommend that kind of action to the full committee. I think that this committee, these committees and this committee are a little bit different from the subcommittees, the formal subcommittees that we set up. And so I'd be happy to take the motion.
Chairman, I move that we recommend that we pass the bill to the full committee with the recommendation that we hold.
It's a motion made, and it's undebatable that we refer this back to the full committee with the recommendation that we hold. All in favor, they call a roll.
Nope,
no discussion on paper.
Right.
different classes?
No.
Different class, different year?
Now, I would assume that, you know, just doing a report of a subcommittee and not receiving a motion, that we would be able to discuss the report for the whole thing.
Thank you.
All I'd like to
do is all the way around, isn't it? I would just like to have a couple of days, take a look at the case law and see if any decisions are lawyers. Take a look at the constitution, how it happens, and then I'm prepared.
Well, I've got to say that the people who are interested in the field, really interested in it, they would have been in there with some types and cookies and so on and so forth. Lobbyists for the school board association and put in there, and just to see if they have anything to say about it.
When will it go before the full committee is motion?
Tomorrow morning. Okay, Friday morning. It'll be on Friday morning. Where is that?
The judiciary committee, February 4th.
I'm hearing on House 1179. We have here Mr. Goodman from the State Department.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Art Goodman from the Justice Department. I'm a budget analyst for the Budget Agency. One of the agencies assigned to me is the Board on Food Standards. When the Board on Food Standards budget was presented to us for review last fall, the proposed funding for the agency was substantially as it had been in the past, and as it is during this biennium, in the amount of 80% highway funds, 20% general funds. We took a look at some work that had been done in other states in funding this kind of agency, and I determined that it would probably be better to fund the agency from an assessment on traffic and other fines, bail forfeitures. The bill as it's presently written would provide for $1 assessment on every fine and bail forfeiture, which would be forwarded to the state treasurer and credited to the police standards and training account for the operation of that agency. The only other source of funds for the agency for the next planning amendment proposed in the area of federal grants. That's about all I can say about the bill. This time, any questions? I'm going to try to answer you.
$504,000, including the government's budget.
Yes, it is, sir.
Why did we carve out the cars left in Las Vegas Park?
Well, of course, the fine on or fine or forfeiture on parking is relatively small, and this would be a pretty high percentage of the fine. It is customary in other states to exclude that type of violation as well as the local ordinance related to the parking.
This is really utilizing criminal law for revenue raising purposes. Do you agree with that fair statement?
Yes, it certainly does raise revenue.
I mean, that's the purpose of it.
Yes, sir. There is another reason, and the primary reason, frankly, that I was thinking of when I first suggested this method, if you care to hear it, it was felt that the highway user, primarily, you know, he's the supporter of this agency, and the about another 20 to 25% in the area will be supported the EHC, and this is kind of a user tax. The training that was put on by the Board of Free Standards and Training is aimed at protecting the citizen, and most of the money is expended because of the type of violence that is primarily our focus.
I'll be very honest with you, I just looked at the bill for the first time this morning. See, there's nothing in the bill which limits it to the operation of motor vehicles or others. So if it includes any type of criminal offense, that where a fine can be imposed.
If it all were a fine to be imposed.
How about, what would be the effect if the judge imposes a fine of $250 and suspends it?
Then it would be more effective.
I assume the same situation would, that is, there would be no assessment if the person were unable to pay the fine and did his one day in jail for each $5.
Yes, sir. Hopefully that's what would happen with the way we go to the bill. I don't see any problem in that area.
Now, presently, we have what is generally referred to as a uniform bail on traffic charges, and I believe that's set to the court today, the Supreme Court, isn't it? Would you assume that there'd have to be a change in uniform bail to add a dollar to each of those, or would there be some machinery whereby it would automatically be added?
Well, this would have to be added. It would probably be a part of the abstract that's filed, and Mr. Betty will hear from Free Standards and Training. He's much more familiar with that system than I am. Perhaps he can answer that question.
I'm very customary for all the way to me. I'm going to say nothing. Mr. Betty, Executive Director of the Board of Free Standards and Training.
Paul Bedio, Executive Director of the Board on Police Standards and Training, and our board supports this new method of financing for our agency. It is something that is being done in several other states. Our closest one is California, and the question that you asked, my understanding in California is that there is a little printed notation called assessment. $1 there is $5 down there. But that is just a matter of handling it in this manner. I don't believe there is any of that. The easy thing to define it itself. Several of the other states are now initiating legislation similar to this. The most recent state is South Carolina, who just this year went into this method.
Five states that are actually using this method now, taking it in. And Texas is coming up with legislation.
California
has had it for some time. Mm-hmm. California's assessment is $5 an hour, just a portion of that goes to Police Standards and Training. Some of it reverts to other agencies. They finance their driving training program as well.
This is a new method. Prior to this time, Board of Public Funds, through the general fund, I guess.
General and highway, 80% highway, 20% general.
The disposition of fines at present time go to the municipality or to the county, or does some go to the state now, out of these traffic fines?
I believe so, if they're written by a state officer or in the building district court, then some of that comes into the state treasury. There's nothing being.
That wouldn't change.
No, nothing is being removed from the cities or the counties. This is an assessment on top of what is there now, so.
Being removed from the dependent.
Well, if you do it $1, and it's really expensive. $5 is much better than $1, isn't it?
Really bad. And comes out even money, I guess.
And the other question, where's the money?
Well, I'm sorry, what is the term on?
This, they testified that this is a method of raising money for support of the city, for the city's funding. But it has been used in California for a number of years. There are about 5 other states that are using it now, and others that are considering it. So, second in California is $5. Rather than one, as opposed to.
One other question.
The logical thing is kind of coming from. If we would pass it, some of the expenses we're raising money, then we lose the kind of the highway funds. We wouldn't be utilizing those funds at all.
These would be the only funds. Plus federal grants.
Just the parking lot, so. Find that number.
Do you have a question from the panel?
Yes, sir.
Is this to be imposed upon every fund? In parking?
No, all except parking.
The parking lot. No.
Oh. What do you anticipate to do between?
$5 million or $500 million.
I assume there will be some, but California tells me almost nothing. It's the same way that they now forward their money to the state treasury. That portion that they do forward. It's just $1 on every forfeiture or bail that's forfeited or fine. Part of the revenue will be reimbursed to the cities and counties because my budget, as it goes through the way it is now, there will be reimbursement to cities and counties for all the police that do attend our police academy. They'll receive at this time $50 a week while they attend the academy, plus all of the expenses at the academy will be paid. California reimburses 50% of that salary. We won't raise enough revenue here to do that.
Are we reimbursing anything now?
Only through a federal grant that we have to the smaller cities of usually 5 men or less. This is the first year we've been able to do that, and we've been able to get people into our academy from those very small areas that have never been able to.
So there is some return to local government.
Oh, yes, local government will. And on top of that, we're going to hopefully provide them with administrative services, which is a consultant type of a thing. If the department needs the assistance of an expert, we will send that man to their department, help them in a new record system or control techniques of some sort of detective, whatever it might be. We'll send a man there and work right with them at no cost to them, stay there, and then come back and help them. Then we'll implement the recommendations. So this will help us and the cities and counties with
what we do something.
So, Chairman, there's one thing that bothers me in respect to this, and I don't know whether you have any suggestion, but I'll mention it many of them. On a fine of $100, this is an assessment of 1%. On a fine of $5, which is a common, or $10, which is the one that the average guy runs into, we're talking about 10 or 20%. It doesn't, to me, seem to be exactly a fair method of distributing the load.
Well, I mentioned this to my budget analyst. Some of the states do take this into account. However, we felt that $1 would probably be enough. South Carolina, that just went into this, would be up to $14.99 for $1. After that, it's $2, up to a certain amount, and anything over 50 or 100 is $5. So they sort of prorated in this manner. And California does it on a percentage basis. It's $5 on the first 20, and I believe it's $5 on every 20 after that. Some of the other states have these percentage type of things. This gets involved in bookkeeping. Where it's a dollar on every one, it sure makes it rather easy to keep that county when you get forward $1. Although,
it's fair to the end of the budget, right?
Well, it's pretty fair. If you think it's just $1 and it could be $5, the guy's getting a better break. I don't know what it is.
Get a better break, there wasn't any of that.
Well, yeah.
$5 a week on the basic course, which is $50 a week reimbursement.
Is that run year round?
That's year round, 5 a year normally.
About 10 courses a year.
Probably the basic course, yeah.
And you have about 20 in the tennis area.
No, we have 40 in the tennis, so I'm 39, somebody dropped out of that last year.
That's 400. 10 courses.
40, well, five, you said a year, I thought. 200 a year, right? 40.
You said about 10 courses a year, 40 or 10 courses at 400.
So 5 courses a year, the basic course.
5 courses a year. So that's
40 weeks.
Doesn't go the year round, right?
No, the academy is only available to us when the military's not using it. And actually, that's the amount of people that we have, roughly 200 weeks.
What's the military use?
Well, during the summer months, July and August, I don't know what they do then.
Play war game.
People out there. This is on the military facility. And the state police use it too for a couple of their state forces. So.
Why give this money back to the pilot?
I'm going to give up. Oriented. It's probably closer to 70 or maybe not even 75. It's a figure that people can't really put their hand on.
If you're giving up all of it, you run down to zero.
Right.
And the legislators have a strong feeling about dedicated time and to honor the others. You might be better off.
We're growing. There's such a need for the services that we provide that there will be probably more money that we'll need. And this way here, we're raising the amount of money that we need to try and get more from highway or the general fund would be rather difficult. And the reimbursement to the local agencies is important. And right now we're talking about $50 a week. That's not enough. It should be closer to half of their salary. I really feel that after we see how much comes in from this dollar a month, we can be a little more realistic and try and get closer to that half of their salary figure. And if it's not enough,
go back to highway.
We'll have to figure out some other method of doing it. We also need in this state a police academy. It might be available this might be later a method of putting away some money to buy the property or putting away some of it in trust to come up with a
thing. What's wrong with that?
Which
also 80% of the time, the fact that you made a policy decision to not request the money to get the title of the company. You know, we don't see many people come down here, but we don't want
to. Can I ask one?
Yes.
I think there's one final reason why we felt that this particular police agency should not be financed primarily from highway funds as a state police, because only about 20 or 25% of Mr. Fenwick's training is directly involved in traffic training. Whereas on the other hand, in the Department of State Police, 80 or 85% of their training and activities are traffic and highway oriented. And this was the primary reason
Does your research tell you what percentage of this $500,000 comes from highway users? What do you project out of this
It will be probably
90%, 95%.
About 70%.
Do you have any indication by town committees or other players that they are going to be an effort to cut down the amount to get in the highway funding?
So that wasn't a factor in our decision as to the method of financing. The budget that we proposed for the state energy control agency would not be different with some highway general fund or from this fund. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else who doesn't fire me? Maybe. Do you wish to take any action on this? Just trying to think about it first. The next measure is something about Douglas County.
Oh my good, I would yell the justice.
I suppose maybe it would be more appropriate for him to lead off than I have to see my purpose of being here. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I'm a detective. I'm a member and past chairman of the State Bar Committee on Police Administration. I'm also a member of the Oregon Judicial Council, although I'm sitting today here only in capacity representing the State Bar. The State Bar has approved the idea of an additional district judge in Douglas County, and at our meeting held last fall in June, we approved the bill, which will include this with a number of other additional judicial positions. Our bar bill has not yet been introduced. We expect that it will be perhaps today or tomorrow. And when it's introduced, it will include an additional district judge for Douglas County and also an additional circuit and one other district judge position in Lane County, believe it. However, this doesn't present any complication. The fact that we'll have two bills doing the same thing, because I assume that all the bills will end up in ways and means anyway, and if they want to handle it by one package, that can be done. If they want to have separate bills for each position or a separate bill for circuit judges and one for district judges, that can be worked out at that time. The important thing now is that there is a real need for an additional district judge in Douglas County. I assume this committee will have available the reports of the Administrative Assistant to Chief Justice 1969 report, I think, is the last one that's been published. The others are ones for 1970. I'm not sure it's in complete form yet, but at least the first two quarters have been announced. For 1969, Douglas County has the highest ratio of cases filed for judge in its district court, something over 12,000 cases there, with a single district judge handling them, which is more than any other county by 50,000. Some of the other counties, well, they ranged all the way down. Klamath is 9,600. Multnomah 8,600, Jackson 8,500. These are cases per judge. So that the Douglas County district judge is handling by far the heaviest load of any district judge in the state. And that's no reflection on the other district judges either. It just means that he has to scramble harder to handle his caseload. And additional statistics indicate that the backlog of cases in the district court of Douglas County is increasing, which is perhaps inevitable with that many filings. The at the end of 69, there were, while 12,300 and some cases have been filed, 11,600 some have been terminated, so that they went behind something over 700 cases in 1969. Of course, that will continue to get worse until something is done about it. So the position of the Oregon State Bar is that an additional district judge is required in Douglas County. Now, if you do not have the table of statistics, you'll see that you get them. I don't have copies for everybody here today, but we'll certainly see if they're made available to you. And I imagine maybe Representative Schultz can add some of the local situation there that I'm not personally familiar with.
You can't do it. You can't let me in. I'll be getting in. Involved in
in either reducing the total caseload or increasing the productivity per judge and getting rid of the cases, or merely by consolidating.
I would expect that the answer is one that could not be given in this committee by anybody except myself, and that is that there are some judges that don't work very hard.
Well,
I hear lawyers express this opinion, but never in public.
None on this.
I just want one other question before we turn it over to the. Is there any state that has a better record than Oregon does in the matter of getting your people into court and getting them completed and getting folks through the whole, in the matter of time, getting them all through the whole process?
I can't say that whether the state has a better record. I can say that Oregon generally ranks very high nationwide, especially in comparison with the large metropolitan areas. Back east, for example, it's common to wait 4 or 5 years to get a defense trial. In Multnomah County, it's around 6 months. And most people who are familiar with such matters think that you can't do a good job of dispensing justice if you bring a case to trial in less than 6 months, because it takes a certain amount of time to prepare a case. Most cases require taking testimony in advance by deposition, requires investigation. Some of them require legal research, requires time to go through the pleadings, which prepare the issues so that the court knows what has to be determined. And you can't really do that in less than about 6 months. So.
We're practically perfect, and I wondered whether we can afford this much perfection or not.
Well, when you're dealing with people's rights, I don't know that there are degrees of perfection. Anything less than perfect is inadequate.
Not desirable. Anything less than adequate welfare counts is not desirable either. And that's just.
With respect to whether some judges are not working hard enough, of course, in some counties, there isn't a caseload. For example, Curry County, just looking at the table I have before me, has 1,210 cases filed in the district court, whereas Douglas County has 12,000, each being handled by one judge. Well, obviously, that's a disproportion. And one of the things I think Justice Connell hopes to accomplish by his merger proposal is to permit assignment of judges around better. Now, in the circuit court, that is presently being done to quite a large extent. Circuit judges sit in other counties on their own to help out when the caseload gets too heavy. The problem is, could you solve that by giving greater administrative power over the district court without having to actually merge them with the circuit court? Maybe you could approach that without having to go all the way into a merger.
Randall, or maybe Dr. Bob, Sally Calder, too, and maybe metropolitan area in any county and one of the lead for it. Do you think it's so prominent?
I don't have anything less than a countywide figure.
Oh, I have a countywide figure also, but
this far taken, given consideration to requiring new district judge and so much of the judicial fees and the court.
We all. Perhaps I didn't answer that this time. Maybe we don't want it down there.
No.
But we have the problem with Leesport having a great too. But
I don't think.
No. And I don't think there'd be a great deal of objection to the abolishment of all JCs other than from the JCs themselves in Douglas County. Except that we can't do it until it's done. And then, off the top of my head, I understand that's the situation. And most of them in the county were re-elected for last election.
What's the
breakdown on the Douglas County District Court from criminal prison.
On criminal cases, there were 9,417 filed and 8,622 terminated. And civil cases, I suppose you could see the difference between that and 12,000.
That's 3/4, I think.
Approximately, yeah.
And then the civil, how many small claims?
That's on a different table. What page is that on?
It's just on 358.
Yes, in the administrative assistance report, there's a breakdown by total traffic misdemeanor, felony, civil, and small claims. And Douglas County has 1,731 small claims out of a total of 12,229. Now, of the 8,217 were traffic cases. 1,011 were misdemeanors, 189 felonies, 1,181 civil.
Does Jackson County have two cases?
Yes, there is. One does now.
And Washington does now also?
Yes.
On page 57 of that same report you're looking at, the earlier page lists all of the district judges in the state.
And on 58, the total cases filed, is that the judges or the entire?
That's the total for the county. So that whereas Multnomah shows 42,000, it has five district judges. So the average is around 8,000.
I noticed that the caseload for Douglas County has been relatively stable for the last 4 to 5 years, and that it's been running around 65,9400 and jumped to 10,111,7114.
I think that's a tribute to the judge handling it, that he's been able to handle that much of a load.
Maybe you could provide a means of receiving those tributes now a little more evenly.
Well, that may well be. It might would still probably be necessary to have additional manpower in Douglas County because of the quarter again higher than the next county to it.
Possibly. I just have one more, Randall, and following up my question. The state bar has no position on whether or not these courts should be regulated so that the district court.
That is right. When it came to us, that was not included, and we just didn't consider that as a possibility. It may well be a good idea. I suppose that the district judge might be able to work that out himself in some manner.
Mr. Chairman, it's bad enough that we're good to ask last session, but with a lawyer or with a doctor on your voice.
We have a resolution of the Denver County Bar Association, which I might give to John and make a part of the record, which reflects basically the same thing that Mr. Kessler has testified. In respect to Ridgeport, I would like to see it included, and the only reason the provision was not made for it in the bill I drafted was what I mentioned, that the present existence of the JT. Douglas County has built a new, what's referred to as a courthouse annex in Ridgeport, and the physical plant is there for handling district court. I would think on the basis of one day a week for a new judge, it could actually be 2 days a week. There's also a JP court in Drain, which is about 50 miles from this court. That is manned by a lawyer. That lawyer.
Is a lawyer doing in Drain?
He's been there since 1931.
Serving the public.
Oh.
Well, there are 1,000 people in Drain.
Explain to me why is it that district court judges can't be moved around like circuit court judges? Just because you don't have any.
Well, they can be, and they are.
But there isn't anybody to move them?
Yeah.
I think it's from one county to another.
I think that's perhaps the problem.
Obviously, this Southern Curry County isn't working very hard. He's only got 10% of cases of Douglas County.
You might have to drive all the way to Curry. No, wait, they just couldn't get it. They'd have to be issued by a judge in the court.
There's no circuit court judge.
There's a circuit court judge. That's the problem, and that's why Justice O'Connell feels that at a single level you wouldn't have the problem, because then both of them would handle both ways.
Actually, the circuit judge can still feel more than he is in Delaware.
Right. See, the district judges are all one county judges. The circuit judges in the less populous areas all have multi county districts and may not actually be within the county. That's the problem. There's enough judicial manpower in the district for a statewide system.
We have received some help out of other judges. Hall has been over on assignment, and Judge can go to see him. Truth comes in occasionally when Catholic is required to be away for vacation. He comes to that part of it, so it's rather rare. But it is inconvenient then within the country.
He's going to the rest of the country taking the four magistrates, and then they have to drive him through the Tokyo where the country goes. So it's an extension. He needs to live in the woods, and it's very difficult for law enforcement officers in the county to put the bill down.
We aren't quite an Eastern Oregon, but we still have wide open spaces.
I think also, you know, maybe we can do appoint lawyers to serve as different judges for the country.
Yes, although I don't know what the situation is in the first one, I'm not aware of it, but in a lot of areas, there's a reluctance, for instance, in the first one area to use it. Pro-tem judges are reluctant to issue search warrants, and the law enforcement agencies and the district attorneys are reluctant to go to pro-tem judges. So, practically, we're reporting this thought that we're going to do pro-tem judges.
Yeah.
Bob, in practice, time, we abandoned the JP court from Tucson. This is just established a clerk system. And the reason I was a clerk.
But
just imagine, if the judge could go to Ridgeport where a trial was, he didn't have to go
we're going to have other bills on this, but we're not waiting for the SUV, and whether we just pass these things on speaking of the way we need, the best way we need, we can make the decision, or whether the military committee should make the real policy decision about what's going to be done about the distribution of course.
Let me make this comment, if I may, Mr. Chairman. This bill is introduced separately because of what we felt was a greater need, perhaps, and I have some knowledge, although this is my first term here, of what oftentimes happens to bar bills, so I sort of wanted to divorce myself from that also. I think it's urgent that we have that, so I don't care how we get it.
When can we expect the other one?
Can we expect that we can get it today?
No.
Then we'll talk to tomorrow.
And Bob, could you tolerate an amendment to the bill concerning the service to report and then the 1% bill amendment? And the second amendment terminating the state's position and report it has to be a community over there or
No, I wouldn't. If you'll do something to solve the problem in those days, same thing.
Or you'll be getting at least a few days of release if you don't have any food sets. Judge, I can't.
No, I don't mean to
go full time.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
I don't know.
No, I'm presuming it.
No, I don't think so. Yes, I think
I just know if you know what my Jackson County here they have asked me for this 2 days a week as possible. And that might be over in any way near far away from
I don't want to fight leave for that.
Well, because you're hard to kill.
Well, this is in the mind
copy of that
This is in the minds of the Board of Commissioners and the people, I think, the JP in Eastport, the elderly, the retired policeman, and perhaps he's not going to fill the 6-year term. And I'm sure that
we're pinching him off.
It's a possibility.
We passed the previous bill. I don't know, I hate to tie the district court with a specific number of days.
Well, I certainly wouldn't be necessary to do that.
It's a matter of the term report,
yeah. Yeah, I can't do that.
Chairman, this is just an off the top of the head remark, and it's not very thoroughly considered. I might want to retract it later, but would the committee be amenable to a general amendment to the district court statute authorizing any district judge to sit any place in the county that he might find convenient to do so? Now, I'm not sure whether it's anything in the other statutes that would create problems with, but possibly this would solve other problems as well.
Not
how do we handle the population? You said it's already been there. That's already been there. And I heard it. Yes, but I heard Mr. McCullough express to you that he was one of the persons that he wanted to do
it. Oh, I know.
Yeah. If the specific judges themselves could work that out, I assume that the chief justice would go along.
Yes, that is true.
Can we be agreeable with you, Bob, then, that we have asked him to prepare these amendments, that we have Mr. McPherson to give us very quickly this old thing, and if we can't quickly come to an agreement on that, that we'll send it on directly to work in
the satisfactory way.
Any further questions about that one? Okay, now we've got some more.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
12:07.
Is that it, Tom?
Below that mark it is.
So on the last session, I put in a bill that was $5 million. And we got down here and we passed out taking requests. One of the streets was $20. And then but we found out that in the Constitution. George came up with an idea and we made an end run, which we made especially past the line of scrimmage in the House that got caught up in the back door of the Senate. The bill was killed because we put a provision in it that included an operation in the collection center which we utilized in small claims court. Our feeling was that small claims basically was for the individual citizen to have a way to go to court without incurring the expense they couldn't afford. And that the purpose of it is not to provide a company to do the business of collection insurance.
You've opened up a whole other problem. You're going to have to solve a couple of other laws. Most collection agencies in Oregon are corporations. One statute says that a corporation can appear in court only by an attorney. The small claims court statute says that an attorney shall not appear without express information of the judge, and that although it can appear by an agent or by an attorney. The judges that I have talked to about it don't know which is the controlling statute or if there's an inherent conflict there. That's the first problem. The second problem is the practical nature. Shall you or shall you not have the collection agency come into the small claims court? If you have them go into the regular side of the court, where they are, most of them are going today, what you have is an increase of work for the district court. Plus the fact that when the credit agency gets their judgment, there is added to that judgment, you pay them a $50 bill. There'll probably be $20 to $30 cost added to that judgment just because of the fact they went through the regular district court procedure. Now, from the standpoint of the defendant being badged by the fourth time collection agency, wouldn't it be better to have that defendant be in small claims court, and if he loses or doesn't show the judgment for $50 instead of being for $80 from the cost he has on it? Well, that's a practical problem.
I also want to point out to you that the national payment for the defendant has to be that the fourth time collection agency of the regular court.
That is true. The fellow hasn't paid the bill to start with, but he doesn't have the money. Now, how is he going to pay an attorney? How is he going to pay the judge? He's not going to pay the cost and time of the judge. I feel that the gist of the bill that we're looking at is to handle it for the ordinary individual, and I think we've got a further problem. I believe that there'll be a bill in the meantime. I think Judge Ellis has more information on it than I have. And you've got that legal problem and the practical problem in the
department. One question. Can we do something about this oral notice in open court that we want to turn? If we're going to raise the limit that much, it's more likely that we're going to be getting more transfers to the district side.
Judge Ellison does that with you too. He, I believe he used to favor something other than the oral notice that he's given. I think that one of the items that come up is perhaps the defendant would have to elect prior to the adjournment case by letter or something. The fact that he's got to take it up to another court. If that waste the court's time by having all the parties appear and the defense said, I want to go to the other court, so everybody stops and leaves. However, 25 cases in the morning, the five go up, we can dispose of 20 of them, and that part of it is it's another problem that's taken care of. But frankly, I feel that if we get the limit raised, we've got a starting point, and we can work on it. So that's probably as we go along.
Good job.
Chair, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to explain a couple of things first about my experience with I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Economic Development, and I was the one who suggested to the committee the increase in jurisdiction. The procedure, Oregon's Constitution guarantees the right to a jury trial if the amount of controversy is over $20. So our statute has been drawn to permit an election. The plaintiff must do in small claims if the amount of fees is less than $20. Above that, the plaintiff has his choice to pursue either an ordinary lawsuit, if in circuit court if he wants to, or he can sue in the district court in ordinary lawsuit. The defendant also has the choice. The amount of controversy is over $20. The defendant can elect to decide if there's any lawsuit. Now, and the reason for that's a statute, that's not the Constitution, but the reason for the statute is the constitutional guarantee of the right to jury trial in the Northern Court. I wanted to explain this while a member of the Assistant Judges Association, I'm not authorized to speak to you on their behalf. I'm a minority, perhaps a minority of one. Trying to increase the use of small claims. This is very unpopular work with judges, and it's because it's very difficult. At least that's the view of most society. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done. Because of the complexity of the cases and the fact that there's no help from lawyers in bringing out the relevant evidence and keeping the chance out and calling your attention to the appropriate legal things. But I might mention my view originally was exactly what you gentlemen have expressed on this, but I had never been in a small claims court until I was appointed to the district court. It was my thought that it ought to be just people litigating the disputes between themselves, and I thought collecting the district could have no proper part there, and in some states of Washington, I believe, do exclude collecting the district. But I've completely changed my view since I've been on the court, because I don't think we, those who created the institution, do the debtors any favor when we force the collection agency that's pursuing him to file a lawsuit and retain a lawyer, particularly when the agreement he's being sued on provides that he pays the expense of that lawyer. Because if the poor devil has no defense, and that's usually the case, it's very rare for a collection agency to lose the case, because in actual fact, the person usually owes the money. In the vast, it's like traffic cases. That's the reason people generally lose in traffic cases is that most of them are guilty of the offense. And you haven't done the defendant a favor when you provide a procedure where, in addition to the debt that he's sued on, say he's sued on a $50 from debt. That's a typical one. And you add over $150 attorney fees and $25 court costs. You haven't really helped him. It may fit our scheme of what's appropriate and fair on the debt. I think the better way to do it is provide a cheap, fast form in which these matters can, if the man has a defense, he can come in and assert it. If he wants to decide an ordinary lawsuit, he always has the right to elect to do that. And undoubtedly, the state and the there will be more of these elections than anything in the constitutional amount. But the defendant, small claims that I was aware of until I started hearing, this is insurance companies and subrogation cases where they pay their loss on the car they insure and they're trying to recover that damage from the person who caused the loss. A lot of insurance companies are now filing these small claims. And they'll even waive the amount over $200. Lots of these claims are $300 or $400, and they're just true for two, whether that was obtained by the asset or not. There's another practice that I think is a bad one. Finance companies suing on notes, that's another class where they're not more than 500 that successfully defend them. The trend where
you may change.
Yeah, that's probably true, but still an awful lot of these, the man did borrow the money, and just on a flat finance company loan, I'm not talking about a car contract, the judges say that's another area, but on a flat loan, it takes a real
resourceful thinking to come up with a potential. And a lot of the finance companies now, this I've learned in hearing these cases, the local agency for the finance company makes a monthly report to their national office. And on all their delinquent accounts, they have to list what they've done. In most cases, they don't want to do anything, but the reason they're in the data isn't that any money. But they've got to put down something. So, and they don't want to spend any money. So, the attorneys now, if they come in, even if they're small claims, then they need to be the judges. They need to report to the judges on collectible and let us write it off. But they'll waive the amount over $200 that's due. They won't waive it. They only sue on the accrued payment after $200. In theory, I suppose they could go back and file another suit. Whether they actually can or not, I'm not sure. I might explain it all that.
They get the $200 and forget the attorney's cost.
Yeah, if they could get it, most of them would be delighted. Now, I've got a breakdown on what we've done in Multnomah County in terms of the number of cases filed and then how those cases were resolved, the number of them that were settled, that amicably paid, the ones in which an effective default judgment was taken against the defendant because it failed to appear, and the ones in which hearings were actually held. There will be a request from the District Judges Association, maybe it's been made already, Carl Francis, asking you, the legislature, to clarify for us, the judges, whether you do or do not want corporations to be permitted to appear in small claims. Because the general statute in Chapter 9 says corporations cannot appear in court except by counsel. And the Small Claims Act says a lawyer can appear in small claims only with the permission of the judge, and the permission is, to my knowledge, never granted. Most district judges isn't quite clear. They don't want to appear in small claims. And this is one way of excluding a vast body of them, because most litigants on one side or the other are going to be corporations. So you can exclude all of them. The same thing is true of state agencies. There's another chapter between the state of Oregon and these companies that can appear only by counsel. Now, in Multnomah County, one of the largest users of small claims is the state of Oregon. The Office of Employment is doing an approved employer tax, usually a very small amount. And I think, personally, this is an excellent service. Again, the reason this employer has not paid that tax is because they have the money. And you do him no favor. Sometimes they disagree. But I think in the 4 months I heard small claims last year, we only tried three of those place cases, and we must have had at least 20 a week. The bookkeeper comes down from the Department of Employment, and he has the records that were submitted, or their audit, and their books, what he's paid in wages from which they received the tax. And here again, I think you do the defendant a favor if you permit the state to sue that way, so that the tax may only be $30. $33, it's always an odd amount. Then the man can come in and defend it himself. That it's difficult enough to compute that tax that neither the agency, or we the people of Oregon, or the defendant can afford to educate a lawyer in what the issue is. It would take far more of his time than the amount of controversy. My personal view is that both corporations are saying that it should be permitted to utilize small claims. So that That's right. I think in Multnomah County, we could, I don't know what our figure was in the cases.
Even though it's hard work.
Between civil. That's right.
I don't object to lawyers working hard. You don't either. It's specified you don't.
I wouldn't be
anything. I would prefer not.
To have a
This is an area I'm afraid where the judge is personally interested in the public service department. In Multnomah County, we handled last in 1969 17,000 some odd civil cases and only 3,800 small claims.
We have five judges.
I think, actually, if we permitted corporations, and if we could eliminate the notice problem, I'll be back with another bill on that. I think that we've found a way we can do to eliminate the problem of the defendant appearing in court and saying on one side this is an ordinary lawsuit and there's a plaintiff with his witnesses already for a hearing. I think that can be eliminated. That's another problem. But I think if we can eliminate the two things, get the jurisdiction will end up, permit corporations and the state to come in and eliminate that particular hearing problem, we could probably transfer half our civil litigation, at least half of our civil litigation in Multnomah County and small claims department. Because the biggest share of the general civil cases also goes to fault. That's why, as I think maybe you spotted, it's not you're comparing apples and oranges when you talk about cases filed in district court and cases filed in circuit court. Because by and large, circuit court cases are not going to involve them. Lawyers don't file cases in circuit court generally unless they think they're going to proceed to trial. As a general rule. And in district court, I think they might be the biggest case to go to the fault case. Because if you go to the fault case, it's cheaper for the lending and for the public.
Would it be fair to say that the one of these small claims things that's handled in the district court under the small claims procedure that it takes about 10% as much of the judge's time as the
well, it's far less than that.
It went to
the almost unheard of for a small claims case hearing to take more than 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to complete a jury trial in less than a half a day. And most of the rest of the state, I understand, that's not the fact. In Multnomah County, we've had a jury case in the morning and one in the afternoon. And there are lots of counties where I understand the jury case in the district court is expected to take a day. Some people drive near the interest.
What percentage of your cases are tried in the
court? I can't give you the figures. We have not ever had the manpower to prepare that kind of record. We're starting to do it now using work studies. And that's how I got the information on small claims. I can give you the ratio of small claims, just information. We had last year about 3,500 files, and of those there were hearings in 750. The rest of them either went to the fault or they turned to the other jury for the amount of settlement. Yes, I think there is. I'm going to try and get something prepared if I can get it in here before we get to what I had in mind was, first of all, to eliminate the timing of hearing days when the case is filed. Instead, give the defendant a notice, like a summons, and give him 10 days to come in and demand a hearing. To require that he pay a nominal filing fee, pay $1 at the time he demands a hearing. But require that if he wants to elect to try it, not just commit him to elect to try it as an ordinary lawsuit, make him demand a jury trial. And at the time he does it, require him to pay a district court defendant's filing fee and a jury fee, right there. Because in actual fact, we lawyers have trained people to do this. People don't elect to try a case as an ordinary lawsuit. They elect to not have the matter tried at all. That's what they do. Because they know that in most other cases, the plaintiff will bring them the claim. Because he'll go to a lawyer and he'll say, I got a $80 claim here against my landlord. He didn't refund my cleaning deposit on my apartment. And the well-advised defendant comes to the landlord and elects to try the ordinary lawsuit. Then he'll go to a lawyer and he says, I want you to help me file this ordinary lawsuit for $80. And the lawyer says, well, I just can't make that kind of donation. You're talking about it. $200 or $300, because the lawyer either he won't charge the man $200 or $300 to handle an $80 matter, or he won't make a donation of the time. Neither one. But I think that's the way we put it in, or at least greatly minimize the problem of the election. And, at least that's my hope.
Well, would you get a bill in on small operations for
we've got those. Every doctor's office got that. Anyone else?
We got on one.
On my bill.
Let me speak up.
Not worth doing.